From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the president of the Boston City Council says that following multiple accusations of corruption against city officials, Boston needs its own inspector general. Also today, parents, does this sound familiar?
Dad, they want us to do it this way.
I don't know that way. Why would they change math? Math is math.
Okay,
math,
Dad.
Is math.
Call us with your math stories, because a new book says that you can be part of the equation. And local musician and Berkeley student Dreon on his viral performance of James Brown's Get On Up.
I don't aim to be better than James Brown. I don't aim to be better than Michael Jackson. I aim to be my best. And so when I get out and perform, you know, it's my duty for me to make the audience feel me more than hear me.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. Good God!
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell wants to establish an independent inspector general to investigate any charges of waste, fraud, and abuse in city government. The context for her proposal? Well, last month, a federal judge found two city hall officials guilty of extortion and conspiracy. And then last week, John Lynch, a former planning agency official, agreed to plead guilty to charges that he accepted $50,000 to influence a vote of the city's zoning board of appeal. Over the weekend, a member of that board resigned. Mayor Walsh has tasked a former federal prosecutor with investigating the ZBA. He also ordered a wider procedural review. Councillor Andrea Campbell says that doesn't go far enough, and she's here in Studio 3 to tell us why. Councillor Campbell, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So why do you think Boston needs its own inspector general?
So for me, as you can imagine, I've been receiving a lot of calls and complaints and concerns with respect to zoning and development. There's a lot of development happening in the city of Boston. Of course, people are paying attention. But when you have folks who are convicted or not just convicted of bribery, but agreeing to pay a fine and possibly go to jail, people are really alarmed. And so rather than sit back and take those concerns and say, let's see what we can do, I said, we have to go and do something. And the time is now to do that. So I'm calling for the creation of an inspector general. We have one at the state level, and I think that's great. But what does it mean to bring it down to the local level where someone can be more hands-on, can be more proactive, not reactive, where there is a sense of making sure that our government is run with transparency, accountability, and overall, this is good governance. I've been reviewing statutes and ordinances from across the country. A lot of cities have this, including Baltimore, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York City. And it's an opportunity not just to respond to the recent incidents of what some people are calling corruption or bad practice, whatever it is. And it's not to also assume that the mayor had a direct hand in any of these things, but particularly Lynch, for example. But it's bigger than that. You know, this is an office that could be used to look at financial auditing departments who have tremendous resources to make sure they're using those resources wisely, efficiently, effectively. And then more importantly, to do it from an independent space where this person in this office is not accountable to the mayor or the city council, but to the public.
Let's pick up this independent idea. I want to ask a little more specifically what an inspector would do, an inspector general would do in that office.
So it could look into investigating not only complaints of corruption or concerns around corruption, around waste. So some departments, for example, folks may come forward and say, what are you doing with our public dollars? I focus a lot on education, and I frequently ask with a large budget of over $1 billion within BPS, for example, how are those dollars being spent and how can we wrap our head around that? We recently had a question around permitting related to a parade. How much money was used for that? Who determined that? What was the process? So this person could look into a lot of different things, have subpoena powers. The list is long, and they should be empowered. This office should be empowered to ensure transparency, accountability with respect to taxpayer dollars, but more importantly, be allowed to investigate to ensure that we are living up to the ideals. And what I mean by that is we say we want transparency, Great. Yep. Let's do it. We say we want to be held accountable if something goes wrong, and that can happen, right? City employees work really hard, but they don't necessarily have the best practices in terms of accountability. So this person would really oversee all of that and it not just from a reactive stance, but from a proactive stance, which is critically important.
Quite powerful. You said subpoena power, for example.
Yes.
So that's a really important appointment. So who makes that appointment, given all the authority that would be in that office?
So if you look across the country, particularly at the cities that have done this, it differentiates. There are some who have the mayor appoint the IG. Some do it the mayor in partnership with a city council. Others have done an advisory board or something more creative, or an ethics commission. I think Baltimore has a great example where they've used an advisory board. And much of what I'm thinking pulls from that, where it's a combination of folks who are appointed not only by the mayor, but also by the council, the city council, but also members of the public are pulled into this advisory board. And this advisory board, which would have to be approved after, say, a public hearing by the council, would then be tasked to hire and put into position an IG.
And then would they have oversight over that IG?
Exactly. Okay. And we could put into place, reasons, the IG can only be released for cause, for example. We've seen that in other ordinances. Making sure they're truly independent, nonpartisan.
Limited terms.
Exactly. But a term limit that covers longer than the period of a council or a mayor term. So, for example, in my recommendations, I say 5 years, which would go longer than a term, a four-year term of a mayor, for example, truly being able to be the fiscal watchdog, an independent watchdog that the taxpayers, I think, deserve. And I want to be crystal clear. This is not about one individual person or one individual case. This is about good governance. And, obviously the recent incident sparked or at least led me to think about not only naming the problem and the concerns around it, but what we could actually do. I always like to be solution oriented, and I think this is a great idea.
Did you have this idea prior to these recent incidents, or is this a relatively new thought of yours?
I had heard about this. So I attend conferences with other city council presidents, for example, who are often talking about the limitations of the council, but particularly Boston City Council, whether it is the Philadelphia City Council, Chicago, Baltimore. And many of these conferences are talking about the authority they have, which far exceeds the city of Boston's council. Even appointments around department heads go through the council. We don't have such authority. So we're trying to, of course, be effective in the work we do, hold folks accountable with the limited authority we have. So I've heard about this IG position, and now it just seemed timely to say this is now the time to do it. What we're talking about warrants the conversation. And I'm excited to have it not only with the mayor and the administration, my colleagues, residents, because I think it's a good one and a good way to go.
Okay, so you talked earlier about the watchdog value of this office. Massachusetts has a U.S. attorney, Andrew Lelling. He's investigating allegations of bribery at the Zoning Board of Appeal. He was part of the conviction of the two former City Hall aides. Mary Marty Walsh himself has tasked a former federal prosecutor, Brian Kelly, with investigating possible corruption at the ZBA. Hired a law firm, Sullivan and Worcester, to do a comprehensive review of the process. Are you arguing that all of that just isn't enough? There needs to be even more?
I think each office plays a different role. So if you look at, for example, our district attorney, she plays a role with respect to how she shows up in the city of Boston.
Rachel Rollins,
investigating homicides and fatalities. The U.S. Attorney's office plays a certain role. The AG's office. I actually just had a meeting with some folks from the AG's office about auto insurance disparities. They play a certain role. But then we have to ask who plays the role within our own city government to make sure that we are delivering good governance to our constituents, ensuring that the money that and the funds and resources that our taxpayers entrust us with is being spent wisely, efficiently, and effectively. And if something goes wrong, that someone is holding us accountable, in all of us, right, including the council. No one, I think, is really tasked with doing that in a direct, proactive way within the city of Boston and within our government. Occasionally, of course, we go to outside firms or others for these investigations, which are costly. They are not cheap. I'm still looking into, it's a part of this conversation, how much these things cost. We might actually save money by creating this office and having someone consistently look at our practices to ensure that we're actually delivering good governance practices to our constituents. And so I'm looking at doing it internally and to a certain extent, obviously within an office within the city of Boston, but that is still an office that is independent, separate and apart from the departments, from the mayor's office, and from the council.
Okay.
And I'll just add, with respect to when we choose a law firm, there's no real process around that. You know, I just learn about, you know, who we pick as a law firm. It's not like the council's involved in that. So this is a, these are public cases. They deserve to be done by a public entity in some way, for the investigation to be public and transparent, and then for the results and all of that to be delivered. And then an IG can decide, for example, if there's some value of bringing in an external law firm, which costs a lot of money. And if so, there should be some justification for that, criteria may be attached, et cetera.
Okay. So we're talking with Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell. I want to ask, did you talk with Mayor Walsh about this idea before you announced it? And what kind of response have you received from the mayor's office?
I did. You know, I gave him a heads up that I looked forward to, that I thought this was a good idea, and that I look forward to engaging with him and his team on this. He was very receptive. I think, you know, to be crystal clear, he too is not happy with Lynch. And from all accounts, he didn't know about it. It was quite a surprise. He is obviously doing what he thinks is best in terms of these investigations, reviewing the practices at the ZBA. And I think that's all great. But for me, it's bigger than the ZBA. It's bigger than zoning and development. We have an opportunity here to create an office that is looking at this all the time. And frankly, I think you sort of give away the burden of always having to look at every department. You can't do that alone. And so why not task someone who with the skill set to be able to do that? And so it's a conversation that will be ongoing with him, his administration. And of course, I have to talk to my colleagues, residents, but folks are already weighing in, which is a really good idea.
Okay.
And saying that they think it's a good idea and something we should absolutely look into, or something that maybe we should have done a long time ago.
Okay. I want to note, we invited Mayor Walsh also to come on the show today. He wasn't available. He did release a statement today. I'm going to read just a little bit of it. Quote, Mayor Walsh welcomes a conversation about additional oversight at the City of Boston, and that's why he's asked for an independent review of this incident and the entire ZBA. It goes on to say that he's, quote, fully committed to overhauling the Zoning Board of Appeal, end quote. There's corruption and then there's influence, and influence is not necessarily illegal. There was an article recently in the Bay State Banner by editor Yahoo Miller, who basically said, you know, the ZBA, the Boston Planning and Development Authority, Inspectional Services were created as checks on the development process. But in reality, there's a really small, tight-knit group of people who hold influence. That seems like an even bigger deal. Will any of that be affected by your proposal here?
I think so. And
how
if
so?
Anything, by creating this office, one, we make it bigger than what the mayor is talking about in his statement. Absolutely, the ZBA and processes around the appointments to the zoning board, who determines the special permits and regulations and the influence that you see at the ZBA. I mean, I've been before the ZBA. I'm a district counselor. We handle development projects all the time. We're on the front lines opposing projects, and ultimately we lose. And it's shocking to me sometimes if you have a lot of residents who are in opposition and we don't win the day. But what I think an IG could do is not only look at practices and policies, but could also be a space to receive some of these concerns and complaints from community. Right now, they come to the council or to colleagues on the council, and we don't necessarily, I can only speak for myself, feel equipped to really address things as adequately as I would like. We don't necessarily have the authority with respect to the zoning. Some of it involves the state. It gets really complex. This office could really be equipped with the authority outside of the the relationships that counselors have, or the their subjective or sometimes objective views on things, to truly be independent to those concerns and complaints that we often get. We get a place to bring those concerns, or an office or a person to bring those concerns to, with the hope that we not only deliver transparency, accountability, and good governance, but also make sure that our processes are objective, that to get things done in this city, that you don't have to have relationships, that everything doesn't have to be relational, and frankly, that it's all couched in equity. Okay. And that's why I'm a firm believer in equity, because it gets away from this idea of everything having to be relational to get things done.
Okay, so we've got about 1 minute left with you.
No
problem. Just very briefly, what's next for the proposal?
So I am currently working on an ordinance and looking at the various models across the country, and we'll put forth one and hope to have it reviewed not only with my colleagues but by the public, to get folks to weigh in, as well as the administration, to ultimately create this office to serve the residents of the city of Boston. And that's who I'm accountable to.
All right. Boston City Council President Andrea Campbell. Councilor Campbell, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for more, let's turn to WBUR reporter Callum Borchers, who's been reporting on the ZBA bribery scandal as it unfolds. Callum, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Gintisiana.
So you were listening just now to the counselor. What's your reaction?
Well, it's a compelling case. And I was on the phone this afternoon with someone in the state inspector general's office seeking comment for some reporting that I'm doing on the John Lynch bribery scandal, seeing if perhaps they would weigh in. And they will not at this point, by the way. But you get a sense for how busy that office is. I mean, the state inspector general is charged with sort of overseeing not only all of the state government, but also all of the city governments, because individual cities like Boston don't have one of their own. So you can see why Councillor Campbell thinks that perhaps Boston ought to get one of its own and have total attention on them.
So we're in a complicated situation that would require oversight right now. Can you lay out the timeline again for us and the key players in this latest city corruption scandal?
Sure. So John Lynch is the principal figure who you mentioned earlier. He's 66 years old and what you'd call a city government lifer. Until last month, he was the assistant director of real estate in a division of the Boston Planning and Development Agency. And according to court documents, he previously spent more than two decades in Boston's Department of Neighborhood Development. So he's been working for the city for a long, long time. The developer who allegedly paid him the $50,000 bribe is not named in court documents, Tiziana, but the documents do include a pretty detailed description that points to a developer named Stephen Turner, and credit the Boston Globe with being the first one to connect all the dots there. Prosecutors say that the developer wanted to sell a piece of property in South Boston in May of 2017, and he needed a favorable vote by the zoning board to maximize the property's value as a place where someone could build an 11-unit condo building. So Lynch is expected to plead guilty tomorrow to taking that $50,000 bribe in exchange for influencing the vote of one of the zoning board members who needed to sign off. Now, the zoning board member is also not named in court documents. Prosecutors describe the member simply as someone Lynch had known for several years on a personal and professional basis. That could be a few different people. And it was sort of a mystery for about a week. And then over the weekend, a ZBA member, Craig Galvin, resigned from the board. And that sort of solved the case.
Although he didn't say that he resigned as a result of this situation.
Did
not correct?
Say explicitly. The logic follows.
Yeah.
And the relationship is there. In fact, Galvin was the listing agent on a property that John Lynch sold recently near his home in Savin Hill. So there is that relationship established.
Okay. So how close do these accusations get to the mayor at this point?
Yeah, I'd call it a glancing blow at this point. Galvin was a Walsh appointee in 2016, so that's not a good reflection, perhaps, but you can't be personally responsible for everything that one of your appointees does, of course. And in response, Walsh is commissioned, as the counselor mentioned earlier, Brian Kelly. He's an attorney. He was the former head of the Public Corruption Unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office to help with this review of the ZBA. And also one of the mayor's top advisors, William Buddy Christopher, is on temporary leave during this investigation. Sort of like a recusal. The connection there is that Christopher was head of the Inspectional Services Department, which is like the building department they issue the permits and do the administrative duties for the zoning board. He also was the original architect on the project in development before he joined city government. So there's enough of a connection there that he has stepped aside for the time being.
All right. So you went to a Zoning Board of Appeal meeting this morning. It was the first one since all this news broke. Was it awkward? How did it go?
It was crowded. The ZBA has never been so popular. I think I was there. Channel 5 was there. The Globe was there. So that's unusual, obviously, for a zoning board meeting. But frankly, it was kind of dull, Tiziana. I mean, there was a brief acknowledgement at the beginning that, like, okay, you know, Galvin has resigned. We thank him for his service. And then it was just a regular zoning board meeting. But I will say it was a reminder, sitting there for about 90 minutes, of how one could sort of easily tuck a little bit of petty corruption into these kinds of proceedings, because everything is sort of so mundane and they move so quickly through project after project that approving one project over another might easily go unnoticed.
All right, Callum, so what questions remain? I mean, this is still unfolding. What remains?
I think what I'm wondering still is, what's the rest of the story, and where are we going to find out? You know, this bribe has been sort of a head-scratcher from the get-go, because the type of zoning variance that the board granted in this case is not uncommon, Tiziana. This is the sort of project that gets approved by the zoning board with some frequency. And for that matter, we don't know exactly how John Lynch is alleged to have influenced the vote of a zoning board member. But even if he did sway that person, we're talking about one vote on a 7-member board. It just seems odd that it's the kind of thing that someone would pay $50,000 for. So I think that's sort of the question is, what else do we not know here?
That is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers. Callum, you're following this closely. We're going to be interested to hear what else you find.
Yes, there'll be more coming on this story this week, starting with what we expect will be a guilty plea formally entered on Thursday.
All right. Well, Callum, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be with you.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and school is back in session. And if you're a parent trying to help your kid with their math homework, it can sometimes feel like this.
That's not the way you're supposed to do it, Dad. They want us to do it this way.
I don't know that way. Why would they change math? Math is math.
It's okay,
math,
Dad.
Is math.
I'll just wait for Mom to get back.
What? Well, she won't understand it any better than I do.
For those of you who don't recognize that clip, or for whom it doesn't strike right at your heart as a parent, it's a scene from The Incredibles 2, when Mr. Incredible is getting frustrated over helping his son Dash with his math homework. And it's a common experience that can leave many parents feeling discouraged. But a new book wants to help. It's called Adding Parents to the Equation. And it's written by Hilary Kreisberg, mathematics professor and director of the Center for Mathematics Achievement at Lesley University, and Matthew Beyranavand, who is the K-12 mathematics department coordinator for Chelmsford Public Schools and a mathematics and education professor at UMass Lowell and Fitchburg State. They both join me now in the studio. Hillary, Matthew, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. We want to hear from you out there on this. Do you struggle to help your kids with their math homework? Are you an educator who gets complaints from parents about that math homework and trying to help their kids with it? Maybe you're a student who's trying really hard to explain your math homework to your parents. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, so why did the two of you write this book? Hillary, go ahead.
Well, I think we should start with Matthew, because he's the one who came and found me, actually.
So, Matthew, tell us.
Yeah, well, I wrote my first book for math teachers called Teach Math Like This, Not Like That. And I had a 3-book deal, and the second book was something that we found, both myself and my publisher, there was a true need for, because parents, as we heard in that clip, don't truly understand the way we do math today. And we'll talk a lot about that during this segment. And so I said to myself, well, I need to bring in myself an expert. I found Hillary, and we just really bonded together and wrote this book as a way to say, parents, here's a resource for you so you can understand the best way to help your child both with the content and the approach.
And okay.
And
anywhere I would go, I'd be in the supermarket, on vacation, I'd hear parents complaining about the new math as they donned it. And I figured if we wrote a book about it, we could at least get the statements out on what is really happening. Why has math shifted in the terms of what parents see?
Okay, so this is a book for both parents and educators. Yeah.
Yeah, we found educators have loved it too, actually, but we originally wrote it for parents.
And you talked, Hillary, just now about, you know, you heard from parents in grocery stores and in public spaces. What, Matthew, were we seeing in the classroom that might also suggest that parents were struggling at home? How does that manifest in the classroom?
Well, to answer that question, I first want to begin by talking about the way we teach the math. Math is still math. It hasn't changed. But we focus more now on the conceptual understanding, the why we do math the way we do it. Why are these the procedures, and less about just memorizing formulas? So what I noticed as an educator is that kids would come home, do their homework, come back, and have these different ways of solving it with a traditional algorithm, which would really hinder their ability to understand the math. So we realized parents didn't really know how to best support their kids.
All right. So I want to talk about this for a second because I have two kids who are high school age now. We went through this experience as a family in our home. My husband and I didn't learn wrong, right?
Correct.
And I have to tell you, as a parent, for you to say, well, you helped your kids solve it another way and you're damaging them when you send them back into the classroom, as a parent, it gets my back up a little bit, right? So how are parents responding to the arguments
sure.
that you're making in the book?
Yeah, I would say we're not saying that for sure. What we're saying now is that the way we're teaching math is significantly different than the way you and I had learned math.
And how.
Yeah, well, we're teaching the why before the how. So instead of teaching adding and subtracting, where we're, you know, we use those terms carry and borrow, and we're very familiar with those terms, we learned how to do it really fast when we were younger. Now kids learn that later on. And first they learn the what, how the why, and how is that working? What does place value actually mean? And when I'm carrying that one, what am I actually doing? And so they learn to be able to apply the math skills in real world situations. And as our world is changing, you know, we're globalizing real fast with technology, and a lot of technology is replacing human jobs where we're computing. And so we need to be able to prepare students for a future that is more than just computing. It's reasoning and thinking through what's happening in front of us.
So 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, are you struggling to help your kids with math at home? What kind of help would you like to have from your child's teachers so you can better support your child at home? So, you know, the implementation of the Common Core curriculum in 2011 was a catalyst for a lot of confusion at home, between parents and classrooms. It's faced resistance since then. Do we have to accept it as is and work around it? And is this part of that change? Or is there something to be said for allowing other methods than what is, you know, whatever you're teaching in the classroom right now, Matthew?
So we are absolutely in favor of multiple ways of solving problems and multiple strategies. And I think the Common Core gets a bad name, a bad rap, mainly because of the way that it was implemented.
Correct.
But we absolutely...
So wait, explain that a little bit.
Sure. So it was really implemented in a way where it was just forced upon without the training and professional development for both educators and parents to understand what it's all about. In its heart, in its root, it really has many great ideas, in particular the standards for mathematical practice as to how we should be approaching problem solving and how we should be learning. And back to that idea that let's first understand what a fraction is and why we need to find a common denominator when we're adding them. And then eventually we want to learn those procedures, those shortcuts, if you will. So it's basically flipping it, where when I learned mathematics, it was all procedural. And until I got into teaching, I never understood why the formula for area of a circle was pi times radius squared. Now we teach so we understand the concepts, and then we move to the traditional algorithms.
All right, go ahead and then we'll take a call. Go ahead.
Other issue that came about when the Common Core came out was that it also was coupled with a change in testing. And so what ended up happening was this piloting of new tests and new standards happened at once. And I think parents and educators conflated the two. The Common Core is a separate issue. It's a set of standards that just tells teachers, here's what students should know at every grade level in this particular learning progression, because teaching mathematics has a sequence so that we can really develop a strong understanding.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Matt from Jamaica Plain, what do you want to share with our guests?
So I remember very clearly when my daughter came home from kindergarten and she put her hands on her hips and said, this is hard. I don't understand. And my response as a parent was not to help her at home. My response at home was to say, you know, Dad's not there in the classroom today to hear how your teacher asked you to do this work. I'm not going to be there tomorrow to help you with this. I might be able to give you a right answer, but I'm not doing my kid any favors by helping them in a way that's half helping. So I think we need to better step back from it, actually, is my comment.
So, Matt, Hillary's nodding at you. Let me let her respond to you.
Yeah, Matt, we are right on board with you. And I want to clarify, when we say adding parents to the equation, we're not talking about being more and more involved. What we're really saying here is that we didn't really involve, as educators, the we being educators, didn't involve parents in the beginning when those new standards came about and when teachers started changing the way they're teaching math. And so our philosophy is, if we want kids to go home and really understand the mathematics, we have to be partners with parents. And parents have to understand what's happening as well. And so what you just said there is really a beautiful statement. I love that you pushed back a little bit and you said, you know what, I'm not going to be there tomorrow. And so you need to figure this out, too. You did exactly what we suggest in our book.
So, Matt, one of the things that can be important to a parent is for their child to recognize that they have knowledge and authority, right? That the parent is somebody the child can turn to for advice and guidance. Parents learned math in a different way than the students are learning it in class today. So how do you convince parents to let go of that need or desire to be authoritative? And what I mean by that is show that they know what they're doing and that they can help. How do you help parents let go?
The most important thing that they can do is to change their own mindset. So often we hear parents saying things like, I can't do math. I can't do the math that you're doing. Or even things like, I hate math.
Okay, I can't do the math.
Yes, you can.
but hold on. But if you are the role model for your child and your child who looks up to you says, oh my gosh, my mom or my dad can't, they're saying they can't do the math.
Yeah.
How can that help me? We never hear people going around saying things like, hey, guess what? I don't know how to read or I don't know how to write. But yet it's socially acceptable to say those things. So the first step is to be able to, if you have those feelings, don't share those, because then it empowers the kids to accept the fact that, oh, I'm not a math person, and everybody truly is a math person.
Or share your struggles and share how you overcame those struggles.
With your child.
Or how you're working to overcome those struggles, even currently. That's fine.
Okay. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation, I'm going to try to get this right. Samara from Providence, Rhode Island. Did I get it right?
It's Samara.
Samara. I do apologize. I really did want to get that right. Samara, what do you have to say with our guests?
No problem. I just want to say that someone with a neurodivergent brain, such as someone with ADD or ADHD, often approaches mathematical equations in a way that I think Common Core is trying to demonstrate. It's kind of thinking of the idea of borrowing numbers and those kind of concepts. I typically tend to use, and that's why I tended to struggle with learning the traditional methods when I was growing up. So I think that it's not a bad idea per se. I think just the execution has been the struggle the past decade or so.
Thanks for that call, Samara. Matthew, you want to respond to that?
I do. So I absolutely agree with what she's saying. We learned with the traditional algorithm, which is abstract terms, symbolic representations, and certain people succeed in that particular format. The Common Core and the way we do math today in schools really promotes the idea of multiple modes of representation. So concrete representation, let's use manipulatives, let's try to do it as a chart or as a table or as a graph. Let's look at those different ways to solve it, and whichever method works best for you, go with that method. So for someone who traditionally likes the memorizing the algorithm and it works for them and they can do it, okay, fine. But for most kids, that's not how they learn best, and we want to support parents to be able to show them the ways so they can help.
Let's take a couple more calls. Hugh from Nashua, you're on with our guests. Go ahead. What do you want to say?
Well, hi there. Yes, I grew up in the 60s learning math, and that phrase the gentleman used about new math was something that was introduced to us, and much of what you're describing is how they're teaching today seems a lot like how I learned growing up in the 60s, and it seems to me we've kind of come full circle with some method of teaching.
Everything old is new again,
yeah,
Hugh.
Right?
That's a
yeah.
good point. Thanks. Jennifer from Worcester, let's add your voice, too. What do you want to say to our panelists?
Hi, I'm a mom of an 8-year-old. She just started third grade. And my problem with the new ways that they're doing math, they don't send home anything for the parents to explain how they're supposed to be helping their kids with their math. And I'd sit down with my daughter and I'd say, okay, well, how'd your teacher do it? And, oh, well, I don't remember. And it was like, well, where's the worksheet for the parents that explains that?
All right. So I think, Hillary, you've got some stuff about that in the book, actually.
Yeah, we have a lot about that in the book. And we're actually working on our next book, which is geared for school leaders and teachers to help them understand how do we add parents to this process. Because what you're stating there is what I see all the time in school districts around the country, that we often aren't educating parents enough. And that's something that educators, we need to take ownership of and we need to do better. If you're a teacher listening and you have a classroom and you haven't sent home a letter to a parent about what you're doing in mathematics this year, make sure you get something out soon. It's the beginning of the year. This is your time to be proactive. It's really important that we as educators inform parents.
1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. We'll take another call. Liz from Wayland, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking the call. This is a great show, great topic, and I really appreciate a refreshed approach to math, including more folks and their learning styles. But I have a couple points. The first one is, I think there are many kids at various levels that find math a very intuitive thing, and this focus on logic actually kind of impedes a place that they could really fly. By the same token, and my second point would be, I think the approach of math today where logic and the process is so important, I think that needs to be fleshed out in curriculum, in English, social studies, places like that, where there might be more this narrative bias and literature focus. I think it needs to be a bit more kind of well-rounded, basically.
Thanks for that, Liz. And I'm going to turn to Matthew for that, because I want to add to that. One of our questions was, well, this thinking process that you're trying to teach kids now, why does it have to be taught in math? Are there other subjects where instead that might be a better way to go? So that's like 17 things. Matthew, mm-hmm. You can just sort of answer all of those.
Absolutely.
He's good at that.
let me just start by talking about the idea of problem solving. To me, when we say, why are we learning math and how do we apply it to the real world? It's not so much, am I going to use this equation or this algebra in the real world? It's to teach the problem solving, critical thinking skills that then helps you become a better member of society. So not everything we do in math can be directly applied. And I do agree with that caller, Lynn, who talked about the idea of logic. And the way we teach math and the way we teach for understanding and the problem-solving skills really promotes that idea of logic and the way you can then interpret and then be able to explain your reasoning.
And this does permeate all other fields, not just mathematics. We just happen to be mathematics content experts, and so we focus on that.
So you're saying that this philosophy of teaching that's being taught through math now is being taught in the other subjects in primary school as well?
Yeah, the other subjects have also changed the way that they're working. You know, the way that we are thinking as society has to shift. Not just in math, but in every subject.
Okay, Matthew, you go ahead, and then I'm going to add a couple more calls here.
Yes, the next generation science standards, which just recently came out, really ties into both the math and the ELA standards, Common Core standards,
English
if you
language.
Will. English language arts standards. So they tie in all together, and they really promote the same ideas there. So we're really trying to take these different subject areas and show how they're all linked together.
Okay, Gil from Martha's Vineyard, you're on the line with our panelists. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, as a senior citizen and as an ex-school teacher and principal, when I had younger kids and my own kids, I simply asked them, when I didn't understand some of the concepts, I asked them to teach me. And that seemed to work very well. They felt empowered. They felt good about themselves. And I wasn't the expert. And I got to learn.
Gil, thanks for that encouraging call. I'm also going to add Kelly from Ipswich. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to call. I've been an educator for about 20 years now, mostly math, but I've taught all the subjects from K through 8th grade. Math is the only subject that a parent will start a parent meeting with, well, I never was good at math,
yep.
So it's no wonder my son or daughter is no good at math. No one ever says, I never got good at science, I never got good at social studies. There's a panic around it, and it's because their education didn't include the foundational understanding that the Common Core is trying to implement now.
Thanks for that, Kelly. You were losing the quality of your line a little bit, so I'm going to let you go. But Hillary, you were nodding. I'll let you come in on that.
Kelly, you just nailed it, and you said it better than I could. We are doing the best that we can now that we know better.
And also, one of the chapters in our book talks about growth mindset, the work that's been developed first by Carol Dweck and now Joe Bowler, both out of Stanford. And we really talk to the parents and share what ways you can promote growth mindset with your kids. And also so they're not thinking those things like, oh, I'm a math person or I'm not a math person.
So what is growth? Very briefly, what does growth mindset mean?
So there's two different types of mindsets. Fixed mindset, where you believe you're either a math person or you're not a math person. You have that ability or you don't have that ability. With a growth mindset, you believe that with hard work, with perseverance, you can do the math. When you make mistakes, it's part of the learning process, and that's okay. And so if we can have students believe that with that hard work, that you show perseverance, everybody can be successful at math. And if you can believe that, the results show that it actually will occur.
And okay, it's not just math. How many times a day do I say, I am not a morning person? Guess what? I could be if I really tried and made an effort.
So Hillary, let me ask you, we're hearing some echoes of parents, either teachers are saying they've heard this from parents or some of the parents are saying, I don't feel confident with my math skills.
Yeah.
So you're saying don't tell your kid you can't do math, but what tools do you use to help your children when you may not as a parent be confident in your own math abilities?
Sure. Well, I think that's why we wrote the book. The book really outlines what the new content is that the kids are learning and how to support that. We've also talked a lot about games. Games are a really great way to play with your child and see what they're doing and how they're learning. And you're going to learn more from your own child than you are from anywhere else because they're the ones in school learning these new methods. But we also want to get educators to be informing parents at home. So sending home a newsletter where you outline what you're going to be teaching and why this is different. And not only that, but how it relates to what we learned is really helpful.
Okay, Matthew, in our last 30 seconds, there's a chapter in the book about what parents can do at home. Lots of great stuff in it. But for that harried parent, maybe a single parent or somebody who's working two jobs, what is the one most important thing they can do to help at home?
Well, I would just echo what Hillary said in regards to games. I am a mathematician, a math educator, and I never do drill and kill with my kids at home. We play board games together that have mathematics enriched with it. We have Prime Climb. We have Tiny Polka Dot. We have King Domino. There's so many games, and by playing it, the mathematics is embedded in it, and then we can have those healthy conversations.
And you can watch some of those games that his kids are playing on our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/addingparents.
All right. That was Hillary Kreisberg, mathematics professor and director of the Center for Mathematics Achievement at Lesley University, and Matthew Beiranavand, who's the K-12 Mathematics Department Coordinator for Chelmsford Public Schools. They're the authors of Adding Parents to the Equation. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Great time. Thank you so much.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is musician and performer Dreon doing his rendition of James Brown's Get On Up. Dreon is a songwriting major at Berklee College of Music. He's originally from Omaha, Nebraska. And a very lively video of his band performing this song, which was posted online by a spectator at a show held at Symphony Park this summer, has garnered over 1.3 million views on Facebook.
Good God!
It caught our attention because of the energy and pure joy of Dreon's performance. We invited him to Studio 3 to speak about how he lays it all out on the stage.
You know, so I aim to be, you know, I don't aim to be better than James Brown. I don't aim to be better than Michael Jackson. I aim to be my best. And so when I get out and perform, you know, it's my duty for me to make the audience feel me more than hear me. So it's amazing when I'm in that element and I'm able to channel my inner James Brown or Michael. And so that's really kind of the headspace I go into, you know, even though I don't compare myself to them, that's who I've trained with. I watch the videos and I sit there in the mirror and I imitate. And so that imitation becomes more of an inspiration. And so when I'm performing, I channel that. I go into this place. I don't want to say I don't go somewhere else, but I like to say that I channel everything that I've learned in that moment, and I just give it my all.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about channeling, you know, James Brown, Michael Jackson, because when one watches that performance, you can see the influences of a wide variety of performers, musicians in your performance. So who has inspired you?
So Michael Jackson, Prince, James Brown, Stevie Wonder, a mentor of mine, Percy Beatty, out of Chicago, and many different genres from R&B, gospel, soul, and funk.
So what do they all have in common? What do you love about this wide range of artists?
I like to say the groove. The groove. It's all about, for me, when someone who doesn't do music or someone who isn't as versed in music as we are can move to it and can get with it, that means that there's something there, that's a connection, because music is a connector.
Is the groove part of what makes that kind of those musicians, that kind of universal musician, universal, because everybody can experience the groove?
Yes, everybody can experience the groove.
You're going to sing a new song in the studio for us.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
So the song is called For a Change is Coming, and I have a saying that simply says, in order to see a change, you have to be the change. And this song has helped motivate me and inspire me for a very long time. I wrote it 3 years ago when I was in Omaha. And I saw this song as a way to express how the world needs unity, and I really want to unify, you know, the world with my music and with my artistry. And so this song just simply says, keep holding on, keep pressing on until you see a change complete. Keep running this race and keep going all the way until you get there, for a change is coming.
I'm excited to hear it.
Thank you.
Let's do it.
Where is the mother doing all she can to ensure that her daughter never runs to abusive men? Where is the father saying, son, here is the key? Only a real man strives for poisoned legacy. I can see how you're feeling now. All hope has gone and bowed down, but the race is given to him who endures. So keep holding on, keep pressing on, till you see a change complete. Just keep running.
All right, so you've been here 4 years now.
Yes.
So what have you taken away from your time here in Boston, and how would you characterize the Boston music scene?
It's so eclectic. There's so many different cultures and people that I've met here who have helped me understand, you know, the power of music and how it is a language in itself. And so here I've been able to experiment with so many different things, from country to reggae to gospel to funk to some of the things that I'm comfortable with and some of the things that I'm not comfortable with. Omaha is like R&B, soul, and like jazz, and there's not too much that changes.
Mm-hmm.
And here it's always changing. And so Boston has really given me a chance to broaden my horizons.
How does that change you as an artist? What do you do differently as a singer or a songwriter or a performer now that you've been able to experiment with all these different genres of music?
So I like to consider myself an imitator. So I imitate and I absorb. And once I imitate and I absorb, then it becomes, you know, inspiration. And then it becomes innovation. I eat the meat and spit out the bones, as my uncle would say. I find things that can nurture my gift and nurture my artistry, and then I use it to elevate.
So keep holding on, keep pressing on, until you see a change complete.
So you're an amazing performer, you're a great singer, you're an inspiring songwriter, and you strive for innovation.
Yes.
Where do you want to be in 10 years?
In 10 years, you know, I hope I can look back on this interview and say, you know, I remember when I did this, because I'm looking to be around the world, international. I want to be an international performing and recording artist. And not for the fame, you know, I believe I have a story, and I believe I have I believe I have something that can inspire the world. As I said, I believe that that, you know, in order to see the change, you have to be the change. And I believe I want to give that message to the world. So I want to tour. I want to release music. I have so much more music, so much more music. But I want to put it all together, and I want to present it to the world. And I would love to be an international recording artist, performing artist, you know, dancing, all of the whole nine.
Well, I have no doubt you have the potential.
Thank you.
That is songwriter and singer Dreon. He's also a student at the Berklee College of Music. Thanks for being at Radio Boston today.
Thank you so much.
It's coming. Keep on.
Dreon will be performing at the Berklee Performance Center in November. More information is at our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
For a change is for